This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Four, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, and the Battle for World Domination by Scott Galloway. Read for you by Jonathan Todd Ross. For Nolan and Alec. I look up, see the stars, and have questions. I look down, see my boys, and have answers. Chapter 1. The Four. Over the last 20 years, four technology giants have inspired more joy, connections, prosperity, and discovery than any entity in history. Along the way, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google have created hundreds of thousands of high-paying jobs. The four are responsible for an array of products and services that are entwined into the daily lives of billions of people. They've put a supercomputer in your pocket, are bringing the internet into developing countries, and are mapping the Earth's landmass and oceans. The four have generated unprecedented wealth, $2.3 trillion, that, via stock ownership, has helped millions of families across the planet build economic security. In sum, they make the world a better place. This is true. And this narrative is espoused, repeatedly, across thousands of media outlets and gatherings of the innovation class, universities, conferences, congressional hearings, boardrooms. However, consider another view. The Four Horsemen. Imagine a retailer that refuses to pay sales tax, treats its employees poorly, destroys hundreds of thousands of jobs, and yet is celebrated as a paragon of business innovation. A computer company that withholds information about a domestic act of terrorism from federal investigators, with the support of a fan following that views the firm similar to a religion. A social media firm that analyzes thousands of images of your children, activates your phone as a listening device, and sells this information to Fortune 500 companies. An ad platform that commands, in some markets, a 90% share of the most lucrative sector in media, yet avoids anti-competitive regulation through aggressive litigation and lobbyists. This narrative is also heard around the world, but in hushed tones. We know these companies aren't benevolent beings, yet we invite them into the most intimate areas of our lives. We willingly divulge personal updates, knowing they'll be used for profit. Our media elevate the executives running these companies to hero status, geniuses to be trusted and emulated. Our governments grant them special treatment regarding antitrust regulation, taxes, even labor laws. And investors bid their stocks up, providing near-infinite capital and firepower to attract the most talented people on the planet or crush adversaries. So, are these entities the four horsemen of God, love, sex, and consumption? Or are they the four horsemen of the apocalypse? The answer is yes to both questions. I'll just call them the four horsemen. How did these companies aggregate so much power? How can an inanimate, for-profit enterprise become so deeply ingrained in our psyche that it reshapes the rules of what a company can do and be? What does unprecedented scale and influence mean for the future of business and the global economy? Are they destined, like other business titans before them, to be eclipsed by younger, sexier rivals? Or have they become so entrenched that nobody, individual, enterprise, government, or otherwise, stands a chance? State of affairs. This is where the four stand at the time of this writing. Amazon. Shopping for a Porsche Panamera Turbo S or a pair of Louboutin lace pumps is fun. Shopping for toothpaste and eco-friendly diapers is not. As the online retailer of choice for most Americans and increasingly the world, Amazon eases the pain of drudgery, getting the stuff you need to survive. No great effort, no hunting, little gathering, just one clicking. Their formula? an unparalleled investment in last-mile infrastructure made possible by an irrationally generous lender. Retail investors who see the most compelling yet simple story ever told in business. Earth's biggest store. The story is coupled with execution that rivals D-Day, minus the whole courage and sacrifice to save the world part. The result is a retailer worth more than Walmart, Target, Macy's, Kroger, Nordstrom, Tiffany & Company, Coach, Williams-Sonoma, Tesco, IKEA, Carrefour, and The Gap combined. As I write this, Jeff Bezos is the third wealthiest person in the world. He will soon be number one. The current gold and silver medalists, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, are in great businesses, software and insurance. But neither sits on top of a company growing 20% plus each year, attacking multi-billion dollar sectors like befuddled prey. Apple. The Apple logo, which graces the most coveted laptops and mobile devices, is the global badge of wealth, education, and Western values. At its core, Apple fills two instinctual needs: to feel closer to God and be more attractive to the opposite sex. It mimics religion with its own belief system, objects of veneration, cult following, and Christ figure. It counts among its congregation the most important people in the world, the innovation class. By achieving a paradoxical goal in business, a low-cost product that sells for a premium price, Apple has become the most profitable company in history. The equivalent is an auto firm with the margins of Ferrari and the production volumes of Toyota. In Q4 of 2016, Apple registered twice the net profits Amazon has produced, in total, since its founding 23 years ago. Apple's cash on hand is nearly the GDP of Denmark. Facebook. As measured by adoption and usage, Facebook is the most successful thing in the history of mankind. There are 7.5 billion people in the world, and 1.2 billion people have a daily relationship with Facebook. Facebook, number one, Facebook Messenger, number two, and Instagram, number eight, are the most popular mobile apps in the United States. The social network and its properties register 50 minutes of a user's typical day. One of every 6 minutes online is spent on Facebook, and one in 5 minutes spent on mobile is on Facebook. Google. Google is a modern man's god. It's our source of knowledge, ever-present, aware of our deepest secrets, reassuring us where we are and where we need to go, answering questions from trivial to profound. No institution has the trust and credibility of Google. About 1 out of 6 queries posed to the search engine have never been asked before. What rabbi, priest, scholar, or coach has so much gravitas that he or she is presented with that many questions never before asked of anybody? Who else inspires so many queries of the unknown from all corners of the world? A subsidiary of Alphabet Inc., in 2016, Google earned $20 billion in profits, increased revenues 23%, and lowered costs to advertisers 11%, a massive blow to competitors. Google, unlike most products, ages in reverse, becoming more valuable with use. It harnesses the power of 2 billion people, 24 hours a day, connected by their intentions, what you want, and decisions, what you choose, yielding a whole infinitely greater than the sum of its parts. The insights into consumer behavior Google gleans from 3.5 billion queries each day make this horseman the executioner of traditional brands and media. Your new favorite brand is what Google returns to you in 0.0000005 second. Show me the trillions. While billions of people derive significant values from these firms and their products, disturbingly few reap the economic benefits. General Motors created economic value of approximately $231,000 per employee, market cap/workforce. This sounds impressive, until you realize that Facebook has created an enterprise worth $20.5 million per employee, or almost 100 times the value per employee of the organizational icon of the last century. Imagine the economic output of a G10 economy generated by the population of Manhattan's Lower East Side. The economic value accretion seems to be defying the law of big numbers and accelerating. In the last 4 years, April 1, 2013 to April 1, 2017, the four increased in value by approximately $1.3 trillion, GDP of Russia. Other tech companies, old and new, big and bigger, are losing relevance. Aging behemoths, including HP and IBM, barely warrant the attention of the four. Thousands of startups fly by like gnats, hardly worth swatting at. Any firm that begins to show the potential to bother the four is acquired, at prices lesser companies can't imagine. Facebook paid nearly $20 billion for 5-year-old, 50-employee instant messaging company WhatsApp. Ultimately, the only competitors the four face are each other. Safety in hatred. Governments, laws, and smaller firms appear helpless to stop the march, regardless of the four's impact on business, society, or the planet. However, there's safety in hatred. Specifically, the four hate each other. They are now competing directly, as their respective sectors are running out of easy prey. Google signaled the end of the brand era as consumers, armed with search, no longer need to defer to the brand, hurting Apple, who also finds itself competing with Amazon in music and film. Amazon is Google's largest customer, but it's also threatening Google in search. 55% of people searching for a product start on Amazon, versus 28% on search engines such as Google. Apple and Amazon are running full speed into each other in front of us, on our TV screens and phones, as Google fights Apple to be the operating system of the product that defines our age, the smartphone. Meanwhile, both Siri, Apple, and Alexa, Amazon, have entered the Thunderdome, where two voices enter and only one will leave. Among online advertisers, Facebook is now taking share from Google as it completes the great pivot from desktop to mobile. And the technology, likely creating more wealth over the next decade, the cloud, a delivery of hosted services over the internet that can be spun up or down based on users' needs, features the Ali versus Frazier battle of the tech age, as Amazon and Google go head-to-head with their respective cloud offerings. The four are engaged in an epic race to become the operating system for our lives. The prize? A $1 trillion-plus valuation, and power and influence greater than any entity in history. So what? To grasp the choices that ushered in the four is to understand business and value creation in the digital age. In the first half of this book, we'll examine each horseman and deconstruct their strategies and the lessons business leaders can draw from them. In the second part of the book, we'll identify and set aside the mythology the four allowed to flourish around the origins of their competitive advantage. Then we'll explore a new model for understanding how these companies exploit our basest instincts for growth and profitability, and show how the four defend their markets with analog moats, real-world infrastructure designed to blunt attacks from potential competitors. What are the horsemen's sins? How do they manipulate governments and competitors to steal IP? That's in Chapter 8. Could there ever be a fifth horseman? In Chapter 9, we'll evaluate the possible candidates, from Netflix to China's retail giant Alibaba, which dwarfs Amazon on many metrics. Do any of them have what it takes to develop a more dominant platform? Finally, in Chapter 10, we'll look at what professional attributes will help you thrive in the age of the four. And in Chapter 11, I'll talk about where the four are taking us. Alexa, who is Scott Galloway? According to Alexa, Scott Robert Galloway is an Australian professional football player who plays as a fullback for Central Coast Mariners in the A-League. That bitch. Anyway, while not a fullback, I've had a front row seat to the Hunger Games of our age. I grew up in an upper-lower middle-class household raised by a superhero, single mother, who worked as a secretary. After college, I spent 2 years at Morgan Stanley in a misguided attempt to be successful and impress women. Investment banking is an awful job, full stop. In addition, I don't possess the skills, maturity, discipline, humility, respect for institutions, to work in a big firm. That is, someone else. So I became an entrepreneur. After business school, I founded Profit, a brand strategy firm that has grown to 400 people helping consumer brands mimic Apple. In 1997, I founded Red Envelope, a multi-channel retailer that went public in 2002 and was slowly bled to death by Amazon. In 2010, I founded L2, a firm that benchmarks the social, search, mobile, and site performance of the world's largest consumer and retail brands. We use data to help Nike, Chanel, L'Oreal, P&G, and one in four of the world's 100 largest consumer firms scale these four summits. In March 2017, L2 was acquired by Gartner, New York Stock Exchange, IT. Along the way, I've served on the boards of media companies, the New York Times Company, Dex Media, Advanstar, all getting crushed by Google and Facebook. I also served on the board of Gateway, which sold 3 times more computers annually than Apple at a fifth the margin. It didn't end well. Finally, I've also served on the boards of Urban Outfitters and Eddie Bauer, each trying to protect their turf from the great white shark of retail, Amazon. However, my business card, which I don't have, reads Professor of Marketing. In 2002, I joined the faculty of NYU's Stern School of Business, where I teach brand strategy and digital marketing, and have taught over 6,000 students. It's a privileged role for me, as I'm the first person on either side of my family to graduate from high school. I'm the product of big government, specifically the University of California, which decided, despite my being a remarkably unremarkable kid, to give me something remarkable. Upward mobility through a world-class education. The pillars of a business school education, which, remarkably, does accelerate students' average salaries from $70,000, applicants, to $100,000 plus, graduates, in just 24 months, are finance, marketing, operations, and management. This curriculum takes up students' entire first year, and the skills learned serve them well the rest of their professional lives. The second year of business school is mostly a waste. Elective, that is, irrelevant, courses that fulfill the teaching requirements of tenured faculty and enable the kids to drink beer and travel to gain fascinating, worthless insight into doing business in Chile, a real course at Stern that gives students credits toward graduation. We require a second year so we can charge tuition of $110,000 versus $50,000 to support a welfare program for the overeducated. Tenure. If we, universities, are to continue raising tuition faster than inflation, and we will, we'll need to build a better foundation for the second year. I believe the business fundamentals of the first year need to be supplemented with similar insights into how these skills are applied in a modern economy. The pillars of the second year should be a study of the four and the sectors they operate in: search, social, brand, and retail. To better understand these firms, the instincts they tap into, and their intersection between technology and stakeholder value, is to gain insight into modern-day business, our world, and ourselves. At the beginning and end of every course at NYU Stern, I tell my students the goal of the course is to provide them with an edge so they too can build economic security for themselves and their families. I wrote this book for the same reason. I hope the listener gains insight and a competitive edge in an economy where it's never been easier to be a billionaire, but it's never been harder to be a millionaire. Chapter 2. Amazon. 44% of U.S. households have a gun, and 52% have Amazon Prime. Wealthy households are more likely to have Amazon Prime than a landline phone. Half of all online growth and 21% of retail growth in the United States in 2016 could be attributed to Amazon. When in a brick-and-mortar store, 1 in 4 consumers check user reviews on Amazon before purchasing. There are several good books, including Brad Stone's impressive The Everything Store, that tell the story of how a hedge fund analyst named Jeff Bezos drove cross-country from New York to Seattle with his wife and formulated his business plan for Amazon while on the road. Many who write about Amazon argue the firm's core assets are its operational capabilities, engineers, or brand. I, on the other hand, would argue that the real reasons Amazon is kicking the collective asses of its competition and its likely ascent to $1 trillion in value are different. Similar to the other four, Amazon's rise rests on its appeal to our instincts. The other wind at its back is a simple, clear story that has enabled it to raise and spend staggering amounts of capital. Hunters and gatherers. Hunting and Gathering, humanity's first and most successful adaptation, occupies more than 90% of human history. By comparison, civilization is little more than a recent blip. It's less awful than it sounds. Paleolithic and Neolithic people spent just 10 to 20 hours a week hunting and gathering the food they needed to survive. The gatherers, in most cases women, were responsible for 80 to 90% of the effort and yield. The hunters mostly provided extra protein. This shouldn't be surprising. Men tend to be better at evaluating at a distance, where prey is first spotted. By comparison, women are typically better at taking stock of their immediate surroundings. Gatherers also needed to be more thoughtful about what they collected. While a tomato couldn't outrun her, the gatherer woman still needed to develop the skills needed to assess nuances, such as ripeness, color, and shape for signs of edibility or disease. The hunter, by comparison, needed to act fast when the opportunity for a kill presented itself. There was no time for nuance, just speed and violence. Once the prey had been killed, the hunters needed to collect the merchandise and get home, pronto, as the fresh kill and even themselves were both attractive targets. Observe how women and men shop, and you'll see that not much has changed. Women feel fabric, try on shoes with a dress, and ask to see things in different colors. Men see something that can sate their appetite, kill, buy, it, and get back to the cave as fast as possible. For our distant ancestors, once the catch was safely back at the cave, the pile never seemed high enough. Famine threatened with every drought, snowstorm, or pestilence. So over-collecting was a smart strategy. The downside of too much stuff was wasted effort. The downside of under-collecting was death from starvation. Humans aren't alone in the compulsion to collect. For males of many animal species, collecting translates to sex. Consider male black wheat ears, avian residents of dry and rocky regions in Eurasia and Africa. They hoard stones. The bigger the pile, the bigger the sales price of that loft in the Tribeca, the more females are interested in mating. Like most neuroses, it starts with the best of intentions and then goes off the rails. Every year there are scores of news stories of people being dug out from stuff that collapsed on them in the discomfort of their home. That guy dug out by firemen from under 45 years of newspapers isn't crazy. He was displaying his Darwinian fitness to anyone who dropped by. Our consuming capitalist selves. Instinct is a powerful chaperone, always watching and whispering in your ear, telling you what you must do to survive. Instinct has a camera, but it's low resolution. It takes hundreds, if not thousands, of years to adapt. Take our affinity for salty, sugary, and fatty foods. It was a rational strategy in humanity's early days, as these ingredients were the most difficult to come by. Not so anymore. We have institutionalized the production of these food groups, like the Burger King Whopper or Wendy's Frosty, to easily meet our needs cost-effectively. Only, our instincts haven't caught up. By 2050, 1 in 3 Americans will likely have diabetes. Our hunger for more stuff hasn't adjusted to our limited closets and wallets either. Many have a difficult time putting food on the table and affording the basics. Yet millions end up on anti-cholesterol drugs like Lipitor and with high-interest credit cards because they can't maintain command over their powerful instinct to collect. Instinct, coupled with a profit motive, makes for excess. And the worst economic system, except for all the rest, capitalism, is specifically designed to maximize that equation. Our economy and prosperity are largely predicated on others' consumption. Fundamental to business is the notion that in a capitalist society, the consumer reigns supreme, and consumption is the most noble of activities. Thus, a country's place in the world is correlated with its level of consumer demand and production. After 9/11, President George W. Bush's advice to a grieving nation was to go down to Disney World in Florida, take your families, and enjoy life the way we want it to be enjoyed. Consumption has taken the place of shared sacrifice during times of war and economic malaise. The nation needs you to keep buying more stuff. Few industries have created more wealth by tapping into our consuming selves than retail. Of the 400 wealthiest people in the world, excluding those who inherited wealth or are in finance, more names on the list are in retail than even technology. Amancio Ortega, the scion of Zara, is the wealthiest man in Europe. Number 3, Bernard Arnault of LVMH, who may be thought of as the father of modern luxury, owns and operates 3,300-plus stores, more than Home Depot. However, the well-publicized successes in retail, coupled with low barriers of entry and the dream of opening one's very own shop, have created an industry that is overstored and, like most industries, in a state of constant flux. Here is how dynamic the U.S. retail environment is. The top 10 best-performing stocks of 1982 were Chrysler, Phase Drug, Coleco, Winnebago, Telex, Mountain Medical, Pulte Home, Home Depot, CACI, and Digital Switch. How many are still around today? The best-performing stock of the 80s? Circuit City. Up 8,250%. In case you don't remember, Circuit City was the now-bankrupt big-box store that sold TVs and other electronics, where service is state-of-the-art. R.I.P. Of the 10 biggest retailers in 1990, only two remain on the list in 2016. Amazon, born in 1994, registered more revenue after 22 years in 2016, $120 billion, than Walmart, founded in 1962, did after 35 years in 1997, $112 billion. In 2016, retail could largely be described as the crazy success of Amazon and the disaster that is the rest of the sector, with a few exceptions, such as Sephora, Fast Fashion, and Warby Parker. E-commerce firms die with a whimper, not a bang, because while brick-and-mortar retail has a face, e-commerce deaths are faceless and not as jarring. One day, that website you regularly visited just isn't there, so you find some other site and never look back. Dead man retailer walking begins with margin erosion, the cholesterol of retail, and ends with endless promotions and sales. You can buy a little time with the sales, but the story almost always ends badly. Holding an average of 12% more inventory in the December 2016 holiday season, retailers increased sales promotions from 34% to 52%. How did we get here? Let's take a brief walk down retail's memory lane. In the United States and Europe, there have been 6 major stages of retail evolution. The corner store. Retailing in the first half of the 20th century was defined by the corner store. Proximity ruled the day. You walked to the store and carried what you could home, sometimes daily. Retail establishments were typically family-run and played a key social role in the community, disseminating local news before radio and TV became dominant. Their competence was customer relationship management, CRM, before that term was invented. Shop owners knew their clientele and would extend credit based upon your good name. Our love affair with retail and the nostalgia we feel when a legendary retailer files for bankruptcy. Notice that it doesn't make the news when a venerable oil equipment leasing firm goes under, is a function of our historic affection for retail, which has been baked into our culture. Department stores. London's Harrods and Newcastle's Bainbridges catered to a new market segment, emerging and affluent females who no longer felt bound by a chaperone. In London, the iconic Selfridges offered 100 departments, restaurants, a roof garden, reading and writing rooms, reception areas for foreign visitors, a first aid room, and knowledgeable floor people. Floor associates were trained and paid via a novel concept, the sales commission. The notion of differentiation through service and of becoming the customer's temporary friend and shopping guide broke new ground. It humanized large-scale retailing and redirected investing toward human capital at the store level. After Selfridges, these celebrations of architecture, lighting, fashion, consumerism, and community spread across Europe and the United States. Department stores also reshaped the relationship between business and consumers. Traditionally, consumer businesses took on a paternal role and told you what was best. The church bank store was in charge. You were supposed to feel fortunate to be blessed with the product of their collective wisdom. It was Harry Selfridge who coined the phrase, "the customer is always right," which at the time might have appeared weak and obsequious. In fact, it was profound and far-reaching. 4 of the 5 oldest surviving retailers are department stores: Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Lord & Taylor, and Brooks Brothers. Call of the Mall. As America barreled toward mid-century, the car and refrigerator meant we could drive farther to get more stuff we could store safely longer. Advances in distribution led to fewer visits, bigger stores, more selection, and lower prices. Department stores evolved into the mall. Also, thanks to the automobile, the suburbs boomed. Developers responded by offering consumers a comfortable destination containing several different stores in one location, connected by food courts and movie theaters. Malls became Main Street for suburbs that didn't have an obvious epicenter. It has always baffled me how much pride people from Short Hills, New Jersey, have in their local mall. It's like owning a Quiznos franchise. I say keep it to yourself. By 1987, half of U.S. retail sales were occurring in malls. But by 2016, business media was bemoaning the end of an American institution. 44% of the value in U.S. malls is in just 100 places, and sales per square foot dropped 24% in the past decade. A mall's health is more a reflection of the local economy than the format itself. Suburban blight has put many out of existence. However, many still thrive, particularly those that have a strong offering, a good mix of stores, parking, and proximity to the upper quartile of income-earning households. The Big Box. 1962 brought us the first American to orbit the Earth, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Beverly Hillbillies, and Walmart, Target, and Kmart. Big box retail caused a dramatic shift in social norms and transformed the retail format. The notion of buying stuff in bulk and passing those savings on to consumers is not on its own revolutionary. More significant is that we as a nation decided to shift the consumer to the front of the line in every way. At Home Depot, you could pick out your own lumber. At Best Buy, you could shop every possible TV and take your choice home in your car. Getting our stuff at the lowest possible price was now more important than any specific company, sector, or even the health of the broader community. The invisible hand began bitch-slapping small or inefficient retailers all over the United States and Europe. Mom-and-pop stores, previously a large part of community life, faced towering competition. The era also saw a new generation of retail infrastructure technology, including the first barcode scanner installed in a Kroger in 1967. Until the 60s, there were laws against retailers offering discounts for bulk purchases. Lawmakers correctly feared this would put thousands of local stores out of business. In addition, manufacturers' brands typically set the prices retailers were allowed to charge for their products. As a result, discounting was a limited and dull-edged weapon. For various reasons, including falling margins and growing competition, those gloves came off in the 60s, and the great race to zero began. Today, on the homepage of HM.com, one can find a long-sleeved ribbed mock turtleneck dress for just $9.99. For the same price, you can also grab a men's textured fine-knit sweater. That's cheap, not only in today's dollars, but in 1962 dollars, a staggering achievement and a testament to a cutthroat race to the bottom. As the shackles came off, the more-for-less big-box monsters created hundreds of billions in wealth. The next 30 years saw what was then the most valuable company and the world's wealthiest man, Sam Walton, emerge from this format, not to mention our collective view that the consumer now reigned supreme. People lament the job-destroying machine that is Amazon, but Walmart was the original gangster. The value proposition was clear and compelling. When you shop at Walmart, it's similar to getting a promotion. You get a better life, featuring Heineken instead of Budweiser beer, and Tide instead of Sun detergent. Specialty retail. Walmart was the great leveler. But most consumers don't want to be equal, they want to be special. And a sizable fraction of the consuming population will pay a premium for that attention. That fraction also tends to be the consumers with the most disposable income. The march toward more for less created a vacuum for consumers looking for expertise and a social signal of something aspirational about their lives. Hence, the rise of specialty retail, which enabled mostly affluent consumers to focus on an exclusive brand or product regardless of price. Thus, Pottery Barn, Whole Foods, and Restoration Hardware. A strong economy helped. This was the prosperous 80s, and young urban professionals found in these specialty stores their homes away from home. Pleasure palaces where they could buy stuff for their homes and closets that better articulated just how cool and cultivated they were. You could find the right pork from an establishment that sold nothing but hams baked in honey, or get the perfect candle from a store that sold only candles, illuminations, or look for some linens and some things. Many of these specialty retailers almost seamlessly transitioned into the era of e-commerce, as many had cut their teeth on direct mail catalogs and were facile with data and fulfillment. The retailer that truly defined the specialty retail era was The Gap. Rather than spending money on advertising, The Gap invested in store experience, becoming the first lifestyle brand. You felt cool shopping at The Gap. While buying a Pottery Barn couch gave a generation of Americans the sense that they had arrived. Specialty retailers recognized that even shopping bags offered a self-expressive benefit. If you carried Williams-Sonoma, you were cool, enjoyed the finer things in life, and had a passion for cooking. The e-commerce opportunity. Jeff Bezos happened more to retail than retail happened to Jeff Bezos. In each of the preceding eras of retail, there were brilliant people who tapped into a shift in demographics or taste and created billions of dollars in value. But Bezos saw a technological shift, then used it to reconstruct, root and branch, the entire world of retailing. E-commerce would be a shadow of itself had Bezos not brought his vision and focus to the medium. In the 1990s, e-commerce was a shitty, unrewarding business for almost every pure-play firm. It still is. The key to success in e-commerce wasn't execution, but creating hype around a company's potential and then selling it to some rich sucker before the house of cards caved in. The most current example is flash sales sites, sites that promised amazing deals, but only at unspecified times. The press went wild. See a pattern? Hype does not equal sales. Retail may have never been, on a risk-adjusted basis, a good business. But it was markedly less awful before Seattle's great white shark of retail showed up and began eating everything. Over the last decade, the market capitalization of the retail icons of the 20th century, from Macy's to JCPenney's, has ranged from awful to disastrous. There is a finite amount of capital invested in each sector, and Amazon's vision and execution has soaked up the preponderance of that investment. The result is a once populous sector that is being ravaged and depopulated by a single player. Because we live in a culture of consumption, the natural trajectory of retail is up. So when the planets align and a new concept works, it can scale rapidly and create tremendous value for consumers and shareholders. Walmart really did give people access to a better, or at least more material, life. And you really can feel better about yourself wearing Zara Silver Patent Platform Oxfords and making juice in a Breville juice fountain from Williams-Sonoma. The difference this time is that this value has been created with unprecedented speed by a single company. Because, being virtual, Amazon can scale to hundreds of millions of customers and scale across almost every retail industry without the traditional drag of having to build brick-and-mortar stores and hire thousands of employees. On Amazon, Bezos realized, every page can be a store and every customer a salesperson. And the company could grow so fast that there wouldn't be any corners left for competitors to carve out a niche. The soon-to-be wealthiest man on the planet. In the first dot-com boom, Jeff Bezos was just another Wall Street escapee with a computer science degree who'd become enamored with the promise of e-commerce. But his vision and maniacal focus would set him head and shoulders above the rest. For his online shopfront, launched in Seattle in 1994, Bezos chose the name Amazon as an indicator of the scale of the flow of merchandise he envisioned. However, another name he considered, he still owns the URL, was more appropriate. Relentless.com. When Bezos started Amazon, online shopping couldn't serve true gatherers because the limited web technology, lame experience, had the nuance and detail of a Lada, the Russian auto brand, ugly and underpowered. Brands are two things, promise and performance. The brand Internet during the 90s and into the noughts was half that. E-commerce in 1995 needed to be prey you recognized easily and could kill and take back to the cave with little loss of value or risk that you accidentally brought a plant back that would poison the clan. Bezos decided this animal was books. Easy to recognize, kill, and digest. Books stacked in a warehouse with a look inside preview. The prey has already been killed and stacked up for you. An industry, book reviewing, emerged to identify what books were worth eating or reading, bypassing the diligence of curation offered by a store. Bezos realized reviews could do the hard work of retailing for him. Amazon could call on the Internet's less lame attributes, selection and distribution. So, no nuance like well-lit storefronts, a door chime, and friendly salespeople. Instead, he leased a warehouse near Seattle Airport and filled it in a way that robots could maneuver easily. In the early days, Amazon focused on books and hunters, people on a mission looking for a specific product. As the years passed, broadband began to offer shades of nuance, and gatherers showed up, willing to browse, weigh options, and take their time. Bezos knew he could migrate to things people weren't used to buying online yet, like CDs and DVDs. Foreshadowing Amazon's threat to all things good in our society, Susan Boyle's CD I Dreamed a Dream set sales records on the platform. To outrun competitors and reinforce the core value of selection, Amazon introduced Amazon Marketplace, letting third parties fill in the long tail. Sellers got access to the world's largest e-commerce platform and customer base, and Amazon was able to balloon its offerings without the expense of additional inventory. Amazon Marketplace now accounts for $40 billion, or 40% of Amazon's sales. Sellers, content with the massive customer flow, feel no compulsion to invest in retail channels of their own. Meanwhile, Amazon gets the data and can enter any business, begin selling products themselves, the moment a category becomes attractive. So, Amazon, should it choose, can begin offering directly old Asian man wall decals, Nicolas Cage pillowcases, and 55-gallon drums of lube. Amazon appeals to our hunter-gatherer instinct to collect more stuff with minimum effort. We have serious mojo for stuff, as survival went to the caveman who had the most twigs, had the right rocks to crack stuff open with, and got the most colorful mud to draw images on walls so his descendants knew when to plant crops or what dangerous animals to avoid. The need for stuff is real. Stuff keeps us warm and safe. It allows us to store and prepare food. It helps us attract mates and care for our offspring. And easy stuff is the best stuff, because it consumes less energy and gives you time to do other important things. Without capital-hungry stores, Bezos could invest in automated warehouses. Scale is power, and Amazon was able to offer prices no brick-and-mortar retailer could afford. He offered deals to loyal customers, to authors, to delivery companies, to resellers agreeing to run ads on their own websites. He drew more and more partners to Amazon. Bezos broke out of the narrow world of books and DVDs and into everything. This kind of experimentation and aggression is what the military calls the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, and act. By acting quickly and decisively, you force the enemy, in this case other retailers, to respond to your last maneuver as you're entering the next one. In Amazon's case, this was done with a ruthless focus on the consumer. It also helped that, for the better part of Amazon's first 15 years in existence, traditional retail CEOs were apt to remind people that e-commerce only accounted for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% of retail. There was never a concerted effort to respond to the threat until Amazon had enormous fangs and unlimited capital. It was too late. Fast forward to 2016. U.S. retail grew 4%, and Amazon Prime grew 40% plus. The internet is the fastest growing channel in the largest economy in the world, and Amazon is capturing the majority of that growth. In the all-important holiday season, November and December 2016, Amazon captured 38% of online sales. The next nine largest online players captured 20% combined. In 2016, Amazon was considered America's most reputable firm. Zero sum. With retail growth essentially flat across the American economy, Amazon's growth must be coming from somewhere. Who's losing? Everyone. The 10-year stock appreciation of major U.S. retailers, 2006 to 2016, says it all. Too many stores, flat wages, changing tastes, and Amazon have created the perfect storm for retail. Today, most retailers are getting shelled. Most, but not all. Amazon has become the prince of darkness for retail, occupying a unique position, inversely correlated to the rest of the sector. Traditionally, stocks in the same sector trade sympathetically, in lockstep with one another. No more. The equity markets now believe that what's good for Amazon is bad for retail, and vice versa. It's a situation almost unique in business history. And it has become a self-fulfilling prophecy, as Amazon's cost of capital declines while every other retailer's increases. It doesn't matter what the reality is. Amazon will win. As it's playing poker with 10 times the chips, Amazon can muscle everyone else out of the game. The real hand-wringing is going to begin when people start asking if what's good for Amazon is bad for society. It's interesting to note that even while some scientists and tech tycoons, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, publicly worry about the dangers of artificial intelligence, and others, Pierre Omidyar, Reid Hoffman, have funded research on the subject, Jeff Bezos is implementing robotics as fast as he can at Amazon. The company increased the number of robots in its warehouses 50% in 2016. With the announcement of Amazon Go, a cashierless convenience store, the firm entered the brick-and-mortar business. But with a twist. Customers at the first Amazon Go groceries and goods stores can simply buy items by walking out of the store. Sensors scan your bags and your app as you walk out. There's no checkout. Other retailers, once again rocked back on their heels, are now scrambling to eliminate their own checkout processes. Whom does this latest Amazon maneuver put at risk? The 3.4 million Americans, 2.6% of the U.S. workforce, employed as cashiers. That's a lot of workers, close to the number of primary and secondary school teachers in the United States. As retailers are coping with the zig of Amazon Go, hardware makers and soon brands are trying to cope with the zag of Amazon Echo. Echo is the speaker-like cylinder, and Alexa is its artificial intelligence, named after the Library of Alexandria. Alexa is designed to operate like a personal communicator, enabling the user to call up music, search the web, and get answers to questions. Most of all, it takes gathering to the next level by ordering through powerful speech recognition software. Say, "Alexa, add Sensodyne to shopping cart." Or, such a pain, "Push a Trojan condom's dash button." And in an hour or less, it's go time. And Alexa gets smarter every time you use it. That's what the customer gets. For Amazon, the reward is greater. Amazon's customers trust it so much that they're allowing the company to listen in on their conversations and harvest their consumption data. This will give Amazon deeper penetration into the private lives and desires of consumers than any other company. In the short term, Go and Echo suggest that the company is headed towards zero-click ordering across its operations. Leveraging big data and unrivaled knowledge of consumer purchasing patterns, Amazon will soon meet your need for stuff without the friction of deciding or ordering. I call this concept Prime Squared. You may need to calibrate every once in a while. Less stuff when you go on vacation, more when you're having people over, less Lindt chocolate when you fall out of love with it. But everything else will operate on retail's equivalent of fly-by-wire. Your order will arrive with an empty box. You'll put the stuff you don't want in the return box, and Amazon will record your preferences. Next time, the return box will get smaller. Amazon made a move in the direction of zero-click ordering when it launched its wardrobe service in June 2017, allowing customers to choose clothes and accessories to try on at home before deciding which to keep. Customers have 7 days to make a decision and are only charged after they've made their selection. Now, compare that to stopping at the shopping center on the way home from work, searching for a parking space, waiting in line only to find that they don't have the kind of light bulb you were looking for, waiting in yet another line for checkout for your other stuff, and then dealing with traffic on the way home. How will the mall or the box store, much less the mom-and-pop shop, compete? We are witnessing the great reckoning in retail. just as we witnessed the percentage of our populace working in agriculture decline from 50% to 4% in a century. We'll see a similar drop over the next 30 years in retail. Amazon's unwavering focus on making consumer purchases increasingly frictionless, its facility with investor relations, and its decision to invest in B2B, platform services for competitors, place it in the pole position for the race to a trillion. What will cement Amazon's ownership of the retail world is its commitment, with every move it makes, to gather mountains of data on every consumer in the world. Amazon already knows a great deal about you and me. Pretty soon it will know more about our shopping preferences than we know ourselves. And we're cool with that, as we will have voluntarily handed over all that information. Storytelling leads to cheap capital. Amazon has had more access to cheaper capital for a longer period than any firm in modern times. Most successful VC-backed tech companies in the 90s raised less than $50 million before showing a return to investors. By comparison, Amazon raised $2.1 billion in investors' money before the company sort of broke even. As the company has shown, Amazon can launch a phone, invest tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars on development and marketing, have it fail within the first 30 days, and then treat the whole disaster as a speed bump. Now that is patient capital. If any other Fortune 500 company, be it HP, Unilever, or Microsoft, launched a phone that proved DOA, their stock would be off 20% plus, as Amazon's stock was in 2014. But as shareholders screamed, the CEOs of those other companies would blink and order a company-wide retreat and pull in its horns. Not Amazon. Why? Because if you have enough chips and can play until sunrise, you'll eventually get blackjack. This cuts to Amazon's core